From KLCC News, this is the Northwest Passage. A fire at the popular hiking spot Mount Pisgah burned more than 50 acres last week. Turns out it was caused by a mower. Springfield City Attorney asked police to wear body cams. An unofficial count tallied more than 38,000 people who were homeless in the Portland metro area. And we talk with reporter Mallory Begay about her recent story on hate crimes in Oregon. These stories and more in this edition of the Northwest Passage podcast from KLCC.
Support for the Northwest Passage comes from Columbia Bank, member FDIC.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us for this week's edition of the Northwest Passage podcast. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald.
News reporter Mallory Begay.
I'm news reporter Amy Brenneman.
I'm Morning Edition host Ani Katz.
In a few minutes, we'll hear from Mallory and Amy about some of the stories they've been working on. But first, Ani, what are some of the top KLCC stories this week?
Shortly after we recorded the podcast last Thursday, there was a fire at the Howard Buford Recreation Area on the east side of Mount Pisgah. We found out that it was caused by a lawnmower. The blaze consumed about 51 acres, again, on the east side of Mount Pisgah, and it actually led to the evacuation and temporary closure of the park. It's obviously since been reopened. The mower was mowing invasive plants in the park. It was operating within the guidelines of industrial fire precaution levels, and the cause has been ruled accidental. The mower was being operated by park people, so it was an accident.
And this really shows you how even when the fire danger isn't considered high, it's still really, really dry out there. And you, and if you've been to Mount Pisgah, you see there's dry grass all over the place and dry brush.
As soon as I got a text from my friend and I texted you that there was a fire, I live fairly close to Mount Pisgah, though on the other side of I-5. And I think my first, you know, image that popped up in my head is like, oh, my God, all that dry grass. Please don't jump the highway. And it didn't. But it was, you know, it was definitely closer to the Eugene metro area than I think any of us were comfortable with.
And Amy spoke with Lane County Parks Division Manager Brett Henry and talked a little bit about what needs to be done as they recover from the fire.
So we'll just have to take a good look at it and see what we need to do. We might need to do some seeding in the areas where there was some extensive burning or fire lines that were cut to prevent erosion when we get into the rainy season in the winter.
So something that we usually report on kind of more in the winter is the official point in time counts that are required by the federal government of people experiencing homelessness. In 2017, in the Portland metro area, 5,700 people were counted as a part of that. Now, a new report from the new study from Portland State University found a very different number, and this news just came out this week. 38,000 people experiencing homelessness in that same area, not 5,700 people. Now, why? This is a more comprehensive count. It's not just going around to parks and shelters counting the people that they see maybe sleeping in cars. They are also looking at people that are experiencing temporary homelessness, like sleeping on a friend's couch or maybe moving in and out of motels. And so it kind of makes you question the numbers that we usually have from this point in time homeless count. For what it's worth, over 1,500 people were counted in Lane County's 2017 count, in Lane County's point in time homeless count. So it kind of makes us wonder what that number might actually be if we looked at these other examples of people experiencing homelessness.
It's definitely clear that it's not an exact science, but that is a huge discrepancy.
It's a huge discrepancy. And I think that this year, if I remember correctly, 2019's count was a huge jump from the previous year. So I'm wondering if they're going to now start looking at other ways of making this count more accurate, because, you know, the reason that this count exists is so that funds can be allocated to support people experiencing homelessness. And it would be good to have an accurate idea of how many people that is. KLCC's Brian Bull did a story this week about how the Springfield City prosecutor wants city police to explore the use of body cameras. At a recent Springfield City Council meeting, Matt Cox, this is the city prosecutor, made the case for the devices. He says they've been effectively used by other police departments around Oregon and are important for accountability and transparency. As a prosecutor, he says, and this is pretty obvious, footage can eliminate gray areas in cases. Eugene implemented its program over 2 years ago with the help of grant money. Officials paid $250,000 towards a federal matching grant that the EPD received in 2017. The biggest costs are docking stations, software, and video storage demands for the body cameras. And Brian reported that the cost is right now the biggest issue for Springfield getting this technology.
So, Amy, talk about what you've been covering this week for KLCC.
One of the stories I did this week that really stuck with me and I loved covering was at LCC, the Student Production Association of Lane Community College and Curtain Call for All is presenting Lighting the Darkness, Stories of Suicide and Carrying On. And this is a collection of three plays that is about losing loved ones to suicide and suicide ideation. And the main goal of the performance is to destigmatize how we discuss suicide. I talked with Executive Director of Curtain Call for All, Bill Ford, who himself had struggled with suicide ideation and losing a loved one to suicide. And he wrote one of the plays in the performance. And he told me that he wants to kind of open up the conversation and make it easier to talk about.
Basically trying to start some of the stuff that I wish I had, or, you know, things that I know will help me. Most of it is just being able to talk about it a little bit more. There's this fear that surrounds the subject of suicide. And one of our main beliefs in Curtain Call for All is that we need to learn to understand that fear so that we can more constructively react to it.
If folks are interested in learning more about that, they can find Amy's story on our website, klcc.org. So, Mallory, we heard a feature from you this week. It looked at white supremacy in Oregon, and it was spurred by graffiti that was painted in downtown Eugene in June. Can you tell us what you were hoping to find out by pursuing this story?
Yeah, and I wanted to put this event, so what happened, just a reminder, was that there were multiple red swastikas found in downtown Eugene. And so that happened a few months ago. And I just wanted to put this event into context with, you know, the current political climate, the recent mass shootings, and the fact that Oregon still has active white nationalist hate groups, while also recognizing the historic presence of racism in the state. Because I think it's easy for people, certain people, to dismiss when these events happen. But that's not true, obviously, for certain people. You know, I spoke with Sabina Stark, whose parents were Holocaust survivors. They passed away in the 70s, but this is something that is still really troubling for her, even though the Holocaust wasn't something she experienced, but just being the child of a survivor, what that felt like for her, and kind of how that traumatic experience is generational. Like, it doesn't just end, and just because there aren't a lot of Holocaust survivors alive, it doesn't mean that that symbol is any less traumatizing or scary, because it's something that no longer just means what it meant during Nazi occupied Germany. Like, it's it's become a more severe symbol of hate. You know, it doesn't just mean something to Jewish people or just to Holocaust survivors, because it was also used by the KKK, and it's still something that is really jarring and scary for marginalized groups in Eugene. And so I kind of wanted to connect those dots as best as I could.
And it was interesting because one of the things I think, you know, that was mentioned was, oh, maybe this graffiti was just done by a kid who doesn't really know what it means. One of the points that I think was really important to cite, which you did in your story, was, you know, this graffiti may have been done by a kid who didn't know what they were doing. But one of your sources talked about that and why it's still really important to take this seriously.
So this is Professor Steve Wasserstrom, a professor who studies Jewish studies at Reed College.
That's tricky, because you don't want to overreact, because if you do, you give the perpetrators free publicity, some of which they are seeking. There's no question that it's tricky also, because in the absence of forensic evidence of the perpetrators, they could very well be comparatively innocent, very young people.
Going back to this idea of intent versus impact, I think is something that a lot of people who, you know, aren't maybe a member of a targeted group, it's easy for them to sort of rationalize this by saying, you know, if it is a kid, it doesn't really matter. Or like maybe we need to focus on what its meaning was prior to World War II or to different cultures. And I think that that isn't true, right? Because the folks that I've interviewed, I myself am somebody who works in a beat or covers a lot of stories that involves marginalized people or groups that affect equity and inclusion. And for them, I think something that I kind of always try to ask is like, why do you think this inequity exists? And so they always point back to, you know, well, Oregon is a state that was kind of founded on racism, and it has a long history of folks who were in the KKK, or the fact that Oregon was an exclusionary state. And I think somebody who really was able to put this into perspective was Eric Ward. He's with Western States, and Western States is a nonprofit that works to address white nationalism in the Pacific Northwest and across the country.
The state still struggles with equity and opportunity because of that historic legacy. But it's not just historic. History never sits in the past. It always feeds and creates conditions that we confront in the present.
Well, I think one of the things that your story did that I thought was impressive was bringing that perspective of, even if it was the daughter of Holocaust survivors, we're losing those voices of people who survived the Holocaust because they're getting old and dying. And so even to hear from her about her parents' experience, I think was very valuable to our listeners. And you can find Mallory's story at klcc.org. This is the Northwest Passage on KLCC. We'll be right back.
Support for KLCC's Northwest Passage is provided by Columbia Bank. Columbia Bank team members have experience in the unique challenges of multiple industries, from healthcare to manufacturing. Learn more about their services for the business community at columbiabank.com. Columbia Bank, where relationships rule. Member FDIC.
You're listening to KLCC's Northwest Passage podcast. I'm News Director Rachel McDonald with Morning Edition host Ani Katz and reporters Mallory Begay and Amy Brenneman. So now it's time for us to talk about a story that caught our eyes this week. Well, one of the stranger things that happened this week was the kerfuffle over President Trump saying he wants to purchase Greenland from Denmark. Some people thought this story was a satire, but sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. And when the Danish prime minister rebuffed him, Trump decided to cancel his state visit to Denmark next week, and he called her nasty. We don't know what's going to come out of this, but it seems like a bad idea to piss off Denmark.
My takeaway this week was the New York Times' 1619 project that was released in the Sunday edition of the paper, and it commemorates the 400-year anniversary of the arrival of the first slave ship. And it's a project that reshapes the dominant American narrative that suggests that the United States of America was founded on July 4th, 1776. So when really America's history started with and was therefore founded on slavery and the racialization in 1619 when the first slave ship arrived. So there are two parts. There's a section of the newspaper that goes over the history and a magazine that uses this history as a basis for understanding contemporary issues that still affect people today because of slavery. And I think it's a big moment in journalism, so much so that I actually went out and bought a physical copy of it on Sunday. I think I bought the last copy at Barnes & Noble. And yeah, so I've just been going through that this week, and it's really enlightening. I learned about 1619, not in history, but I did learn about it. The only way that I learned about it was because I took an African-American literature class. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I wouldn't have known. But even still, it's a really great read. I think, yeah, like I said, I think it's a big moment in journalism. They also have a podcast, I think.
Mm-hmm. They
and
do.
It's yeah. turning into a curriculum. They're turning it into a curriculum that's going to be released in schools, or schools can use it. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I was able to read a little bit of that series, and it's really interesting. I mean, it goes into the economics of slavery, which is fascinating. I mean, basically, the United States was the reason that United States is an economic power is because of slavery.
I think I heard something. This was kind of listening out of the corner of my ear, you know, reporters who worked on the New York Times story or project was something that, you know, trillions of dollars is how much they were able to, you know, I'm using air quotes, save by using slave labor instead of actually paying people, which is crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. On to sperm.
So Ani's got a scientific story for us.
I've got some science for you. Yes. So Rob Stein at this point is essentially NPR's like CRISPR correspondent. I mean, he's a science correspondent, but basically we hear him talk about designer babies, CRISPR. Those are a lot of things that Rob Stein covers. I first learned about CRISPR a couple years ago when Radiolab did, I think it was actually a two-part show about CRISPR, which is a way that scientists can make very precise changes to DNA, like little taking tiny, you know, making tiny little manipulations to DNA. If you go find that Radiolab episode and you're interested in science, I highly recommend it. The question is now that scientists are working on is, can you do it on a sperm cell to fix genetic mutations? The issue in the past year or so was that a Chinese doctor was found to have edited embryos to make, I think they were twins, immune to HIV. And that was, of course, very controversial when they did that. Now, the idea is that they're thinking that editing sperm could be safer than editing embryos. So that's something that Rob Stein did a very interesting story about this morning. And I would definitely check it out.
After 19 weeks of being number one on Billboard's Hot 100, Lil Nas X's Old Town Road has been replaced by Billie Eilish's Bad Guy. And both Lil Nas X and Billie Eilish are breaking records left and right and kind of just changing the industry. So in case you don't know, Lil Nas X, he's a 20-year-old rapper and country singer who's, you know, changing the game because he's mixing together rap and hip hop and country and combining them. He also is a black gay man who's a chart topper in both the rap genre and the country genre. And so his 19-week record of being number one broke previous records previously held by people such as Mariah Carey, Whitney Houston, and Louis Fonsi. And then Billie Eilish, who's only 17, similarly subverts genre labels by mixing together and combining genres like EDM, pop, and industrial trap. And she's also breaking records left and right. She's the first person that's born in the 21st century to be a chart topper. And wow. Yeah. and then her debut album, When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go?, broke records because 12 of its 13 songs were charted on the list, which is the most for any female musician ever. And then she also had the second highest first week album sales of 2009, right behind Ariana Grande.
I think there's nothing like a 17-year-old getting like a top Billboard, you know, like to make me feel like a total underachiever. But I have to say, I was a little sad that Lil Nas X got displaced because I spent all of my last weekend listening to one of my favorite 3-year-olds in the world rap his version of Old Town Road. And I don't know, it really is like it's a pretty good competition between the two.
I got the horses in the back, horse stock is attached, head is matted black, got the bushes black to match.
Well, thanks so much everyone for joining us for the Northwest Passage on KLCC. I'm Rachel McDonald.
I'm Morning Edition host Donnie Katz.
I'm news reporter Amy Brenneman.
I'm news reporter Mallory Begay.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Support for the Northwest Passage comes from Columbia Bank, member FDIC.